You're about to hear a digitized message from the Lutheran Hour. All rights on the program and its copyrighted content are reserved by the International Lutheran Layman's League. Permission was granted for Concordia Theological Seminary to digitize this message. For more information on the Lutheran Hour, or for questions about special uses of this material, go to lhm.org or call 1-800-876-9880.
This will be a special broadcast of the Lutheran Hour, a very special broadcast. It commemorates a great event, not only in the history of the Lutheran Hour, but also in the witness of the Christian Church throughout the world.
Bringing Christ to the nations, the Lutheran Hour. Thursday, October 2nd of this past week, marked the 50th anniversary of the very first broadcast of this radio ministry to a coast-to-coast network audience in the United States. In observance of that anniversary, we of the International Lutheran Layman's League are pleased to present a special program featuring Dr. Oswald Hoffman, who has just completed 25 years as speaker on this program, and Dr. Paul L. Meyer, son of Dr. Walter A. Meyer, Sr., founder and first speaker on this program. During the ensuing minutes, these two men of God will share with you some of the highlights of gospel broadcasting that came to mind as they engaged in a recent conversation in our studios. And now, here is Dr. Hoffman.
50 years ago, the first broadcast of the Lutheran Hour went out over the network in the United States of America, bringing Christ to the nations. That has become the motto of the Lutheran Hour over these 50 years. But it is more than a motto, it is a way of life. And I guess you might say it was the way of life of Dr. Walter A. Meyer, who was not only the first speaker on the Lutheran Hour, but was the guiding spirit of the Lutheran Hour, and I guess you could also say the impelling force behind the Lutheran Hour. If it had not been for Dr. Meyer, there probably would not have been a broadcast like this at that time. It may have come later in some other way, but it came in 1930 with that dynamic man behind the microphone, and we commemorate that day in this special broadcast. With me to commemorate this event is one of Dr. Meyer's sons, Dr. Paul Meyer from Kalamazoo, Michigan, very gifted man, who wrote the biography of his father called A Man Spoke, A World Listened, which is certainly one of the great biographies of a Christian leader in the history of Christian biography. And I tell you something, Paul, I remember you as a little boy in those days when the broadcast started back there in 1930. You were in the household, and you were there at dinner in the evening when some of us came over to eat dinner with your parents.
It's kind of fascinating, Dr. Hoffman, to notice that I was born actually on the very day that the Lutheran Hour was born, May 31st, 1930. It was a resolution of the Lutheran Layman's League in convention assembled at the Palmer House in Chicago that determined to have a National Lutheran Radio Hour on the CBS network that fall. And the calendar this year falls in exactly the same position as the calendar back in 1930, because it was this past Thursday, October 2nd, when the first broadcast emanated from station WHK in Cleveland, Ohio. And it was on a Thursday. Cleveland, because the Cleveland Bach Chorus was supposed to provide Lutheranism's finest music for that occasion. And Thursday, because at that time there was a lot of concern among the clergy, not shared by my father, that if the broadcast were held on a Sunday, people would neglect going to church and they would simply stay home conveniently and listen to the service over the radio. And so it was that over the 36-station network of CBS, the broadcast would begin on Thursday night, October 2nd, 1930. And the Lutheran Hour almost died aborning because of a technicality in which CBS suddenly worried about the idea of a spiritual or religious broadcast right during its prime amusement hours. Program scheduled at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, 9 Central, 8 Mountain, 7 Pacific. You couldn't find a better time in the broadcast day, right in the middle of the amusement hours, than that. As a matter of fact, the program immediately preceding the Lutheran Hour was The Shadow. And the network officials decided that the sermon portion of the broadcast would have to be cut down from 19 minutes to 16 minutes, and my father had abridged his sermon in accordance with that directive. But then, with just minutes to airtime, came news that he would have to cut the sermon down to 9 minutes. And of course, since preaching the gospel has been the core purpose of the Lutheran Hour from its very inception, he drew the line. He said, "I cannot comply with this unwarranted restriction. I must refuse to broadcast." And so the Lutheran Hour was actually dying right at its birth pangs. And with minutes to go, a compromise was hastily worked out whereby CBS softened its stand and my father trimmed only two or three paragraphs and then probably preached a little faster to make up for the difference. And so the Lutheran Hour was born anyway.
I remember that day. All of us hung around this box, which was a pretty big box in the living room in those days, and were we proud to hear this voice coming out over those airwaves. I'll never forget that in my whole lifetime, how we all sat there and felt at that moment. The fact of the matter is that your father took the church right out on the main street there at that moment.
What was amazing was the male response more than justified the whole enterprise, because within a month or two, network newcomer Meyer was receiving more mail than even the hit shows like Amos and Andy, and CBS suddenly realized, say, they had a winner on their hands anyway, and they removed that restriction, and so it filled up 19 minutes of airtime anyway.
How did your father feel about all that?
Thrilled, and so was the whole church. So was the Lutheran Layman's League and the Walther League and the other sponsoring agencies. It was an exciting moment. The only problem was timing. As you well know, 1930 and 31 comes just a year after 1929, the great stock market crash, and of course the full effects of the Depression were not felt until the earliest 30s. And so what happened, of course, was that listener contributions fell alarmingly in the cold early months of 1931. And finally, the Lutheran Hour, as you know, had to go off the air temporarily in June of 1931 because the sad story of Depression economics made all that inevitable. And for 3.5 years, there was no Lutheran Hour, but it was then resumed in 1935 through the vision of the Detroit Lutheran Pastoral Conference. They had a very successful little show in two stations in the Michigan Radio Network, and they decided to add the strong station WXYZ Detroit and superpower WLW Cincinnati to this little chain. And so the Lutheran Hour was reborn, a renaissance, in 1935. And the mail, again, came from every state east of the Rockies and more than justified that enterprise. And then the fall of 1935 saw the beginning of the third Lutheran Hour season, emanating from station KFUO in St. Louis, which is still the world's oldest religious broadcasting station. And for the rest of my father's life, when he wasn't speaking at Lutheran Hour rallies elsewhere, the program originated from Studio C in KFUO. And the Lutheran Layman's League then resumed sponsorship, and all the graph for station emanations, broadcasting countries, mail received, were accelerating from that point on.
1935 really marked the beginning of the broadcast as it is known today.
Switching to a Sunday schedule, for example.
That is right. And when it went off the air in 1931, to many people that didn't look temporary. That's another feather in your father's cap. And that is, he did not give up. To a lot of people, this was the end. We tried it, and it didn't work. I can remember that feeling at that time. But he and others, too, a lot of others who helped along in this regard, saw to it that the next time that they started out in a modest way, we just on a few stations, and then gradually built up until it became the great and extensive broadcast that it has become down through the years. What was your father's purpose in all this?
The whole idea, of course, was through modern technology to help fulfill that great directive of Christ on the hillside outside of Jerusalem, simply go into all the world and preach the good news to the whole creation. That, at the time, would have seemed impossible to the apostles, of course. I think the first time my father donned earphones and tickled his crystal with a cat's whisker, the idea burned through his head. That the gospel, after all, is composed of words, words about what God, the Creator God, has done for us, saving us in Christ. And this word can be communicated through teaching in the classroom or reading in Scripture or hearing in the sermon or through the invisible voice coming through electronics. This hadn't been visualized, of course, by St. Paul when he said, how shall they hear without a preacher in Romans? Well, the fact is, still true, but the preacher in this case is unseen and comes through the air alone via electronics. And the opportunities of radio were incredible to my father's imagination from the start. He visualized how this thing could spread to people who were unchurched, for example, to those who had to be unchurched, like forest rangers and the fringe occupations and the vocations that would prevent them from being in touch with regular church worship. The sick, the shut-ins, the convalescents, those in prison, those on military maneuvers, those at a distance from the church's regular outreach, immediately they could be touched with the good news. And so this was what contributed, I think, to the vision he had here for preaching the gospel quite literally into all the world.
He was not content just to broadcast in the United States.
No, that was clear about 1937 or 38. Well, first of all, Canada, naturally, just over the border, was an obvious new penetration point for the Lutheran Hour. But then came the opportunity to broadcast over station HCJB in Quito, Ecuador, through Clarence Jones' kind invitation. And a Spanish Lutheran Hour was born, Cristo para todas las naciones. And from there on, the languages would be added as additional hemispheres, additional continents were reached. It is a marvelous success story, purely on human terms, I would suggest. But because everybody involved with the inception and growth of the Lutheran Hour were amateurs, I think we have to bring in the divine factor, because under normal circumstances, you would not have a group of even gifted amateurs putting this thing together and having it spread as successfully as it did without God's blessing. And every time, as you well know, my father was asked for the reasons for the success of the broadcast, he would always say, SDG, Soli Deo Gloria, to God alone the glory, as every one of his Lutheran Hour sermons were prefixed with the initials I-N-J, in nomine Jesu, in the name of Jesus. And so this was indeed the divine dimension which has to account for Lutheran Hour's success.
Well, I think it was the very substance of the thing. Because he was always telling people, not about himself, but about Jesus Christ.
That's so true. I, at the same time, want to give due credit to the staff that assisted him through the years. There was magnificent service.
Yeah, but you're talking about amateurs. But there's one who is no amateur. And he is Lord. And you know what? Your father was so devoted to him that in everything he did, he was always pushing for Jesus Christ. I remember that missionary society we had at the seminary. He was one of the few people at that time who realized the potential of young men at the seminary for going out and reaching people with the gospel. And you know, the church had been willing to sit on its hands for a long time or take the attitude, we're here and the people know we're here, and so they'll come and beat a path to our door. And I'm not exaggerating that. It was exactly the attitude at that time. And your father said, we've got to get out there. And you remember, not all seminary students were convinced that this was exactly the way to do things, to go down to Hooverville in St. Louis and preach to the people who were living in hovels that time because of the depression, all that. But some of us got the idea, and we got it from him. From no one else. And if he hadn't been pushing this, I don't think that we would have done things like that. We admired that no end. He did not get complete cooperation from even some of his colleagues, you know, in this kind of attitude. But he was all for bringing to the world Jesus Christ. But that's one thing he got across to us. And it wasn't just radio, or it wasn't just one method that he became obsessed with or something like that. He was interested in bringing the gospel to people in every way possible. In that way, he was just like St. Paul.
Very versatile man. It's interesting that he could have pursued two or three other careers, and as a matter of fact, he did. He was professor of Old Testament. He wrote scholarly commentaries in books of the Bible, like this commentary in the book of Nahum. He wrote actually the equivalent of 32 books, 22 of which were published, 3 in manuscript, and 10 booklets containing his sermons, his thoughts on marriage, and many other areas. He edited a magazine for 25 years. All in one lifetime, he did all this.
What was the magazine?
The Walther League Messenger.
It was for young people.
For young people and middle-aged and old. It became the family magazine of the Lutheran Church in those days, as you well know.
He kept that up, too, didn't he?
Until 1945.
Yes. While he was Lutheran, our speaker.
Concurrently. Concurrently. Yep. He led 3 lives. He really did, quite literally.
Yeah. No. Well, I always felt that he could have been president of the largest corporations in the world and would have been very successful at almost anything that he tried. That's how able he was. And he had was this winning personality to go with it, too. When he smiled at you, you remembered it for the rest of your life. I still meet people who say to me, I shook the hand of Dr. Meyer. And I respect that feeling on their part because that was an event in their lives.
It's remarkable. It's been 30 years now since he passed away, and people remember him as though it were yesterday. He became certainly a Sunday institution in their lives. And again and again and again, they'll tell me the same thing, Dr. Hoffman, about, oh, that's your father. Well, I met him. He shook my hand. He smiled at me or something like that. It's really very rewarding. And it is fascinating to go through the Walther League Messenger editorials and articles and see how very predictive he could be. Not as a prophet in the many misunderstood senses today, but because he was so well in touch with the pulse of events of his own day, he could extrapolate. He could predict for the future what would take place. And in my new anthology, The Best of Walter A. Meyer, I have a list, a whole chapter, of about 25 to 30 specific predictions he made that were fulfilled within 10 or 15 or 20 years after he predicted that exactly that would happen.
You know, there were all kinds of issues before the public at that time, and he didn't run away from them at all. Now, let's make this clear. He was preaching the gospel to people, the gospel of Jesus Christ. But he was finding people confronted by certain problems. He did not run away from those problems. You probably, in your selection of all of these excerpts from your father's works, would run into a lot of those things. What were some of those issues that he did not hesitate to take up?
Well, of course, atheistic communism, simply because of that adjective, atheistic, was not just a whipping boy as such, but a very serious concern of his. He was concerned with the rather godless modernism of the 30s and the 40s, in which everything but Christ was being preached by our theologians and in the churches which they influenced. He was concerned by the rampant vice of his day, the rising divorce and crime rate, the difficulties between race, the war-mongering by some of the lobbies in Congress and elsewhere. He didn't hesitate to draw richly on the political and economic and social atmosphere of the day for purposes of sermon illustration. And, of course, he had one of the most massive filing systems known to man. He had 120 drawers, full file drawers, of relevant clippings, excerpts, statistics, or whatever might not only brighten or illustrate the point he was making in his Lutheran Hour sermons, but provide a treasure trove of additional information. And that's why we find quite a documentary approach in many of his sermons. He couldn't always preach this on the air, by the way, because he regularly would produce a Lutheran Hour sermon that was about 70% longer than he could ever broadcast in the studio. And right up to the last minute, he was canceling paragraphs and sections to leave only the meat there, and then later this material would be produced in his sermon book. So it wasn't wasted effort at the time. But I just can't conceive of working that much harder than you had to myself.
That explains something. Why those sermons in the sermon books he published were so long, and yet the broadcasts were not all that long. He must have been a lot like Martin Luther. I've always suspected that the sermons of Martin Luther as printed were a lot longer than they were as they were delivered.
I think they had to have been, and probably the same thing applied to Luther as my father's statement. If I try something, I must exhaust my subject. I must exhaust my subject. The old perfectionism in terms of doing everything to a high standard of excellence.
Well, let's begin to talk about the man personally just a little bit, because he's such an interesting personality.
Back in 1935, for the second Lutheran Hour, the announcer from Detroit was none other than Brace Beamer, the original Lone Ranger. And he was a dramatic actor with great panache and flash, and he tried to improve the oratorical technique of the Old Testament professor. He'd say, no, Dr. Meyer, you're too fast. Slow it down. Give it depth and drama. And then my father would imitate him, ape him, and slow things down. And then when the light went on, he would go off in his own style. Anyway, no difficulty.
You know, nobody was going to change him in
right.
his ways. Most of the listeners, I don't think, had any idea that Dr. Meyer was a very highly educated man. He spoke the language of the people, and he never made any point of this. But he was a Ph.D. in Semitic languages from Harvard University. And in fact, he spoke with something of an Eastern accent because he was raised out there near Boston, Massachusetts, in Quincy. And when you people were raised in your home, how was it at home with him?
It was exciting. It really was. You know, so often you hear interviews with sons or daughters of celebrities who claim that they didn't enjoy the goldfish bowl type existence and so on, were always being compared unfavorably with their parents. That doesn't bother me at all. I'm not trying to be another Dr. Meyer as such. I'm doing my own thing. And it was just an exhilarating existence. It really was. And one thing I do want to stress, too, is the beautiful point of contact between yourself, Dr. Hoffman, and my father, lest we forget this. It's fascinating to notice that one of the brightest students in my father's Old Testament sections was none other than a distinguished fellow named Oswald C.J. Hoffman. And for that expertise, he was given the job of being class marker, as a matter of fact. And I can tell you very truthfully that if my father were alive and had known that you would be the Lutheran Hour successor, he would be thrilled and gratified and thank God, because you have carried it magnificently over the past quarter century. And you appreciated, I think, as much as anyone else what my father's ministry was. It was just the Sunday after he was laid to rest that memorial services were held all over the world. And one, particularly in Manhattan, was addressed by none other than yourself before, 5 years before you became Lutheran Hour speaker. And I'd like to quote from one thing you said in that address, because it's not only very touching, but very true. You said, "It's safe to say that no man in the first half of this century anywhere in the world so touched the hearts of the suffering masses in this country and abroad as Walter Meyer did. In the cultivated accents of Harvard, he spoke of Christ to the common man. Whatever he touched leaped into life. His breath was on the neck of the entire church, urging it forward in its mission for Christ, since he asserted that time is short." Here I wrote a whole book on his ministry, but I couldn't capsulize in one paragraph better than that what he was like.
Well, you wrote a beautiful book, and you're a worthy son of your father, as is your brother, who is named Dr. Walter A. Meyer, Jr., of course. And we're just going to have to say at this moment, thank God for such a man. Thank God for Jesus Christ, who's given us such a mission. And thank God for such a medium as radio, to be able to proclaim to people all over the world the good news of God in Jesus Christ, and to bring Christ to the nations.
men of the Concordia Seminary Chorus have just sung Alleluia from Coronation Anthem No. 2, The King Shall Rejoice by George Frideric Handel.